Hello, everyone. This is Dr. Pamela Brewer welcoming you to this edition of Thoughtful Thursday. Every Thursday, you and I have the opportunity to hear from someone else, another expert, who has information to share with us that will definitely give you new information and hopefully expand your perspective about the world in which you live. Today is no different. I am very pleased to introduce to you Dr. David Sack. Dr. David Sack is an addiction psychiatrist and chief medical officer at Elements Behavioral Health. Dr. Sack, welcome to Mind Talk.
Oh, thank you so much for inviting me.
Now, Dr. Sack, Elements Behavioral Health, where are they located?
So our corporate headquarters is in Long Beach, but we have treatment programs throughout the United States. Probably our best-known centers are Promises Treatment Centers in California and in Texas, and the ranch, the Recovery Ranch in Nunnally, Tennessee. But we have programs in Florida, Pennsylvania, New Jersey, Arizona, and Utah, as well as Texas.
Well, if you're the chief medical officer and there are all those locations, can I assume that you're pretty busy all of the time?
I'm a busy camper. A lot of what I do is implementing new programs, helping to supervise our medical teams, create consistency across the clinical system of care.
Well, now, I just introduced you and described you as an addiction psychiatrist. What does that mean versus someone else who simply identifies themselves as a psychiatrist?
About 20 years ago, our board, the American Board of Psychiatry and Neurology, realized that there were underserved clinical populations and where the knowledge was evolving very rapidly about how to diagnose and treat certain problems. And among the areas that were identified, one was addiction medicine. And the reality was is that psychiatry historically hadn't done enough for addiction. And so they developed fellowships for addiction psychiatry and specialized training. And so someone who is board certified in addiction psychiatry has had additional training and has passed an examination that shows that they have qualifications to treat people with severe addictions.
All right. So should someone who is dealing with an addiction only look specifically for an addiction psychiatrist?
Well, if they do, they'll be looking for a long time because
okay.
There aren't many of us yet.
Okay.
So most of the people who work in this field arrived at it through their own clinical practices. That is, they learned about addiction because they were working with people with addictions, and so that most of the people who work in this space are not specifically trained. They're really generalists. But that's starting to change, and more residents who are finishing their psychiatry training are choosing to go into addiction and specifically do fellowships.
Well, let's start with your definition of what an addiction is. I think there's a lot of confusion on the parts of many people about what precisely it means to be addicted.
So the American Society of Addiction Medicine, which is another organization, has recently come out with a revised definition of addiction that describes it as a disorder of the brain's reward circuitry and the related areas, where the person engages in a behavior or a drug that hyperstimulates the reward centers in the brain, and as a result, there are corresponding changes in behaviors and memory and in actions that are induced by the hyperstimulation of the reward center. You know, we used to think about addiction only in terms of drugs that had very profound withdrawal syndromes, but we now know that people can become severely addicted to drugs that don't have medically serious withdrawal syndromes.
That's interesting. Can you say more about that?
Sure. So if someone is an alcoholic, so they're addicted to alcohol, and they stop drinking and they're a high user of alcohol, they're at risk for having seizures, insomnia, hallucinations, delusions, even death from respiratory arrest. If you look at someone who's addicted to cocaine, if they stop using, they may feel tired, irritable, restless, but they don't have any medically serious consequences from stopping it. So 80 years ago, people said, well, I guess cocaine isn't that addicting because of the withdrawal syndrome is not very severe. But it turns out that people who have cocaine problems have very intense cravings, and they're not able to stay in treatment frequently because they can't stop thinking about the drug and obtaining it. So even though they don't have physical consequences, they have the changes in the reward centers in the brain that create very powerful behavioral changes and make it very hard to quit.
What is your thought about medications that might be prescribed to help folks dealing with an addiction?
So today, we only have effective medications for a couple of kinds of addiction. Probably the best treatments we have actually have to do with nicotine and stopping smoking. So in the case of smoking cessation, we have three effective drugs. We have the nicotine patches, we have bupropion, and we have something called varenicline, or the brand name is Chantix. In the case of alcohol, you know, we have three treatments, but none of them work all that well. So they are helpful, but they're definitely not the whole story. So with alcohol, we have Anabuse, which is a medicine that makes people sick if they drink. We have a medicine called Vivitrol that partially blocks the reward effects of alcohol. In other words, it makes it less rewarding when people drink, and it also decreases cravings. And then we have a medicine called Acamprosate or Campril that seems to quiet the craving, the longer-term cravings for alcohol. So again, we're starting to have medicines that can be helpful with some of these addictions. In the case of opiates, we have three main treatments that can be helpful. And in general, the treatments follow one of two paths. The treatments either are replacements for that drug, sort of a kinder, gentler, safer form of the drug that the person might have been using, but one that doesn't get them high in the same way, or they're drugs that block the receptor systems that are stimulated by those drugs. So an example of a replacement strategy is the person who's addicted to cigarettes, we give them a nicotine patch. We're giving them a replacement that doesn't have the health problems of actually smoking cigarettes. And so it's a net benefit, and eventually they're able to wean off of it. You know, in the case of alcohol, if we give naltrexone, we're blocking an effect of alcohol so that we're making it less enjoyable so that people are less likely to use. So those have been the two main paths that drug treatments have gone down for addiction.
Now, with those medications, it's dependent upon the individual actually taking the drug, or are they available by injection?
So you're absolutely right. You know, if you don't take it, they don't work. And so in the case of naltrexone, there is now a long-acting injectable form of naltrexone that's used for both opiate dependency, that is addiction to prescription drugs as well as heroin, and can be used for alcohol. And not surprisingly, the long-acting injectable form works much better than oral naltrexone. It's both safer and more effective because it doesn't rely on the individual remembering to take it every day. In the case of methadone, which is frequently used for heroin and other opiate addictions, the person has to come in every day to the clinic to get their dose so that the staff is very aware if they're missing doses.
Okay. And with naltrexone, is that self-administered or does that have to be delivered by a medical professional?
The shot has to be delivered by a medical professional.
Okay. So it seems to me that in both of those instances, that, as you said, has far greater potential for actually working consistently than relying on somebody to pop a pill.
That's right.
We are talking so far about drugs and alcohol, but are there other kinds of addictions that folks might find themselves dealing with?
So there's a whole group of behaviors that have been described that we think are very closely related to the drug kinds of addictions, and those are called impulse control disorders, and that includes compulsive gambling, spending, hypersexuality are the most common ones that get described in the literature, and we think that they're very closely related, and that's because if you look at what happens in the brain's reward centers, all of these behaviors stimulate the nucleus accumbens, which is the reward central of the brain, in a very similar way to what drugs do. And we know that elevating brain dopamine, which is a reward chemical, increases the likelihood of developing any one of these problems.
So as you're identifying these particular potential addictions, are you including in that porn addiction, sex addiction, love addiction, if there's any such thing, a work addiction, if there's any such thing?
So work addiction hasn't been fully studied, but I certainly consider sexual addiction and porn addiction as being in that continuum. The way in which people use pornography compulsively, or the people that we see for sexual addiction, are doing it in a way that is very similar to how people engage in drug addiction. There's a compulsive searching for the reward. They'll spend hours looking at images on the internet, and then once they have gratified that, they immediately are craving more of it. And so the behaviors look very much like other addictions. And when you look at the history of people who have sexual addiction, because we treat a lot of people with sexual addictions at our program in Tennessee at the ranch, where we have a dedicated program for men and a separate program for women with sexual addictions, that what you see is that a very high proportion of them have used drugs or alcohol in the past, particularly cocaine or stimulants. So again, it suggests that that these disorders are very much connected to other addictions.
Can you describe for those unbelievers, if you will, who would characterize a porn addiction or a sex addiction as simply somebody who's a cheater? They can stop whenever they want to. They just don't want to. Can you give us some information about porn and sex addiction?
Sure. But I think it's important for the listeners to keep in mind that many people feel that same way about people who drink alcohol or take cocaine, that they could stop any time and just put the drink down and it'll be all over. What distinguishes people with addiction is the way in which the reward affects them. So that, people who become addicted, whether it's to pornography or to a drug, have this intense craving for it. That is, they cannot be without it. They're preoccupied. Their day becomes organized around it. And so that they spend more and more time getting and obtaining that drug in spite of the consequences and damage that it causes them. And the same thing is true for pornography. We frequently at the ranch see people who have been terminated from work because they were looking at pornography at work. Now, there isn't anyone in today's world who doesn't know that their employers can monitor and observe which websites they're going to. And so, when people compulsively look at pornography at work, they're essentially doing it in the face of what is an inevitable consequence, that they're going to get terminated for violating company policy. And so, the person who engages in pornography is often in a very disrupted relationship with their partner because they're more interested in the visual images and the online images than they are in the relationship. And so they'll watch their marriages and families fall apart and continue to engage in the pornography. So it's the continuation of the behavior in the face of serious consequences that distinguishes the addiction. People with sexual addiction are often spending large amounts of money on online sex, on prostitutes, on traveling to sex clubs, and really to their financial ruin. And in that sense, it's quite a lot like gambling, where people continue to gamble even though they've acquired debts, they can't service them, and their lives and safety may even be in jeopardy.
In terms of a gambling addiction, how does one know, actually in terms of any of the addictions, but particularly with a gambling addiction, how do you know that you're not somebody who just really has fun gambling versus somebody who's really addicted and is in trouble?
So some of the things that we've used historically to help us define alcoholism are very helpful for things like gambling and sexual addiction. For instance, has the person made repeated attempts to stop and been unsuccessful? When you talk to compulsive gamblers, they'll tell you that they tried to stop and they went 2 days and then the next thing they were in a poker club. So that one criteria is, have they tried to stop? A second criteria is, are they spending more and more time in that activity in a way that takes them away from other commitments and obligations. So people who are compulsive gamblers frequently slip out from work. They take 2 or 3 hour lunches. They lose track of time because they're at the card clubs. They call in sick. They have excessive absences, very much in a way that's similar to the alcoholics whose disease has progressed. So spending more and more time, not being able to stop even when you try, and then the continuing of the behavior in the face of consequences. So the person who has now missed their rent and they're getting eviction notices, whose utilities are being cut off because they haven't paid those bills, you know, those are the kinds of things that when people continue the behavior in spite of those consequences, tell us that they're truly addicted, not just that this is a fun behavior for them.
So for the person who's thinking, if he really loved me, he would stop. If she really cared about me, she would stop. That's not the equation to really think about.
That's correct. And the reason why it's not is because what's happened is that there have been changes in the reward centers in the brain where the parts of the brain that evaluate things are impaired. So impulsivity goes up. That is, people become more impulsive, so they're not able to resist these urges. And their empathy, that is, the amount that they're able to care about other people's feelings and needs, actually goes down. And we can show that people who become addicted have less empathy, that is, they're not able to really appreciate what it's like to be in another person's shoes when they're in the throes of their addiction.
So it sounds pretty scary for the person who's not addicted but watching a loved one or just someone they happen to know sort of go through this process.
It is scary because, you know, if you, most people, when they enter a relationship with someone, that person is either not addicted or they're in the earlier stages of it. So they can have a close, loving, and at times reciprocal relationship with that person. But as the addiction progresses, more and more, the only thing that matters is getting and obtaining the drug or the behavior. So whether it's cocaine or prostitutes or gambling, that takes over. And we can actually show that there are changes in very specific parts of the brain, the ventral medial prefrontal cortex, it's a big word, but actually changes, and that the level of activity there in situations that should stimulate empathy and caring for other people diminishes with the addiction.
Yeah, I think it cannot be underscored enough that addictions are more than someone engaging in behavior that somebody else might not like or understand or appreciate. But when you talk about the brain actually being changed, I mean, that's a very big deal that I'm not sure enough people wrap their heads around.
You know, you're absolutely right. And part of it is because not everybody is vulnerable to addiction and not everyone is attracted to the same drugs. So, you know, when I was growing up in high school, they would, you know, in middle school, they'd show us videotapes of, if you ever touch heroin, you're going to be addicted. You know, well, it turns out that only about 1 out of 5 or 1 out of 6 people who tries heroin becomes addicted to it. That doesn't mean that heroin is not addicting, but what it means is that there are lots of people who, having tried it, don't really have any interest in it or craving for it. And that's pretty much true for every drug. You know, about 90% of kids try cigarettes before they graduate high school, but only about 1 out of 7 becomes addicted. So that part of what happens is that people who are not addicted can't understand how that drug can so dominate the addict's life or that behavior. In other words, so that, because they don't have that experience, they don't have this feeling that their life has been or their world has been transformed. When you talk to adolescent alcoholics who became heavy alcoholics after very short periods of time, they will tell you that they never felt truly alive or happy until they started drinking. And that's a very different experience than a typical social drinker who can take it or leave it. You know, yeah, I got a little silly, enjoyed the conversation a little bit more, but it is not the same power over them because they don't experience it the same way.
Dr. Sack, we're going to take a break, but when we come up, you've brought up adolescent alcoholics. And again, I think that's another area where there is growing awareness, but still sort of a lot of pushback. Not my child. It couldn't be my child. My child's too young. All those kinds of things. So when we come back, I'd like to spend some more time specifically talking about adolescence and adolescent addiction.
Terrific. I look forward to it.
Folks, this is Pamela Brewer. You're listening to Mind Talk. Don't go away. We'll be back in a moment. Dr. Sack, when we think about adolescents becoming addicted, on some levels, that's kind of like every parent's nightmare. And on another level, every parent knows that that would never be their child because they come from fill-in-the-blanks kind of home, fill-in-the-blanks kind of experiences. Who are the adolescents who find themselves addicted, and what is the age range?
Sure. So what we see is that drug and alcohol use often begins as early as fifth or sixth grade in middle school. And, you know, one of the big differences between adults that become addicted and adolescents who become addicted is that a very high proportion, probably 70% of adolescents who abuse drugs or alcohol have had other emotional problems that long predate the use of drugs or alcohol. So they're what we would call relief users. They're people who have been frequently abused as children or who have ADHD, so they're not accepted. They have attention deficit disorder, hyperactivity, so they're not accepted by their peers. They're rejected by their teachers. They don't feel they fit in. We see kids with social phobia and school phobias who are tremendously anxious when they have to be in social situations. And again, they don't have friends and support groups the way you would think, you know, normal kids would have. Depression is a common problem. So when you look at kids who are who develop drug or alcohol problems as young teenagers and even high schoolers, a much higher proportion of them have had mental health problems before. So as a parent, you may have a great home and you may have three kids, and two of them may be doing just fine, but the third, you know, is struggling and was struggling with emotional problems long before they hit middle school. So I think that part of the message is that if you're a parent and your kid's struggling, you want to get them help as early as possible, and you want to make sure that you're not taking it for granted. A lot of times, if you're a parent and your kid has attention deficit disorder, you know, you get tired of fighting with them over their homework. You get tired of fighting with them over taking their medicine, and you don't really see the benefit. But what happens is that when they are out of treatment or where they're not getting counseling, things get much worse, and they're sort of drawn toward drugs or alcohol. You know, clearly social influences are a big factor in adolescent drug use. So when people are using drugs, they're typically using it with buddies who are also using drugs. So one of the most common changes that parents notice is a change in friends, that the person stops hanging out with the people who've been their friends their whole life and starts hanging out with other people who are doing poorly in school, who are truant, and who have other problems.
What about teachers? Is there something that, are there behaviors that teachers would notice and should consider that there might be a substance abuse issue?
Well, you know, irritability and oppositionalism are really common things when people are using drugs. A person who's smoking pot may feel calmer when they're high on marijuana, but as it wears off, they become more irritable, more paranoid, more oppositional, more indifferent. And so if you're a teacher and you've got kids in the class that are exceptionally moody or who are withdrawn, you know, if people are using drugs during the day, you know, if somebody is stealing the pain medication out of their parents' cabinet, which is something that we see commonly in our young adult program, it promises that people's first experience with pain medicine isn't on the street, but in getting it, you know, from home. they may come to school and be, you know, drowsy and tired and inattentive in a way that says that something is wrong. You know, they're not getting enough sleep, or they're taking drugs that are making them inattentive and unresponsive. So I think that, you know, for teachers, there are often indications that something is not right, but it's not always clear that it's a drug. But I think that when you have a kid with behavioral changes, if the school system is supportive and if there are, you know, counselors that they can go to, often the truth comes out there.
If a teacher sees a child in class who he or she thinks is pretty clear that kid is high or drunk, what obligations, if any, does the teacher have in terms of telling someone?
So it's rarely that cut and dried, because the kids who are very impaired just don't show up for school. And so they're going to get picked up through a truancy system. But what more likely happens is that the kid doesn't seem right, and they send them to the school nurse, and then there's a responsibility on the part of the nurse to investigate it, to call the family, to get more information. If they suspect that there are issues of neglect or abuse, there is usually mandatory reporting requirements. But again, you know, most people who are using drugs are good at concealing it up to a point. They're not as good at it as they think, but they are masters of deceit and concealment, so they're going to do everything they can to avoid situations where it becomes tremendously obvious.
So many of the commercials that we see on television have to do with various online games. And some of them, from my perspective, are pretty disturbing. But nevertheless, we've got lots of kids, I would think, who are becoming addicted to playing these various online games. What is your sense of that?
We think that these online games are often a lot like compulsive gambling, especially the ones that involve massive multi-user interfaces where they're essentially substituting their own world for this manufactured reality, and where they're spending, again, more and more time at it, where their rewards and satisfaction comes from the game rather than from other life activities. And so, you know, again, it hasn't been as extensively studied as things like gambling or even sexual addiction, but we think that the behaviors have many similarities, especially this kind of total immersion and distraction from other things.
And for adults, do you find that adults might fall in this category as well, or is this really something that you see more in adolescents?
You see it more in adolescents and young adults. I'm not sure I have a clear explanation of why that is. But, you know, we don't see many people in any of our programs who are 40 years old that are spending 8 hours a day on Internet gaming.
Probably because they need to do other things at 40 years old, whether they want to or not.
I guess.
Are you seeing any changes in the trends of substances that are being used or the way in which they're being used over time?
Well, actually, there are some very interesting trends.
You know,
one of the trends that we've seen nationally is an increase in binge drinking among young and reproductive age women. So the 20 to 40-year-old women, the frequency and severity of binge drinking has gone up significantly over the last 10 years. And we're seeing that at college campuses. We see it in our young adult programs. It's not unusual for us to see a syndrome that's been called drunkorexia, but really what it is severe binge drinking in young women, where in addition to binge drinking, they're restricting their food intake, and they may be purging. So they're not only are they creating a dangerous situation, because the amount of alcohol they're drinking in a sitting could be, you know, anywhere from 5 to 20 drinks, but they're also creating electrolyte disturbances that make it even more dangerous.
20 drinks at one sitting sounds pretty huge. I mean, 5 is more than a notion, but 20?
Well, wow. You know, the way they define dangerous drinking or binge drinking would be in men 5 drinks in a 4-hour period, and in women it would be four drinks, you know, four or more drinks. So you're absolutely right. By the time you're getting to four or five drinks, you're already, you've waded into some pretty dangerous territory in terms of blood alcohol levels.
It really is pretty scary.
Yes. And again, you know, what happens, you know, when young women drink is then they become vulnerable to other other problems. They're victims of sexual assaults. They may drive recklessly. They may get into cars with other people who are impaired. So the number of bad things that happen to you when you're binge drinking really goes up exponentially.
What is dabbing?
So dabbing has to do with a form of marijuana. Essentially, it's the resin that's highly extracted from marijuana plants. And then instead of smoking it as in a joint, you basically take a hot needle or a pipe, and then this highly potent form of marijuana that could be 80 to 90% pure gets inhaled. And so a lot of the concern about dabbing is that you're now dealing with a form of marijuana that's very different than smoking pot, where the concentration is usually somewhere around 5%, you know, to 10%. So you're talking about, you know, 8 or 9 times the potency of marijuana. And so not surprisingly, people become dizzy and delirious, and it's not unusual for them to wind up in an emergency room as a result of dabbing. The other problem is that the most common way in which the marijuana is extracted involves using solvents that are highly flammable. And so the people who are doing their own extractions are frequently creating fires and blowing themselves up. So it's not unusual to see third-degree burns in people who were careless using the butane to extract the marijuana. So dabbing is a problem on lots of different levels, but, you know, there's a tendency, particularly in young adults when they use drugs, to want to outdo each other. So whatever the most potent form of a drug is, they want to show that they've been there and done that. And so dabbing is very attractive for that reason.
Is dabbing something that's new, or has it been around for a while?
Well, you know, we've always had, you know, pot resins that were for sale, you know, and so, you know, but what is different about dabbing is how potent it is, that the chemical processes that are used have gotten more sophisticated. So, you know, I think that what makes it different is that it's so potent that very, very tiny amounts have profound effects on the brain. Most people don't understand that marijuana, you know, stimulates a specific receptor system in the brain that's very important in regulating a whole host of other systems. So the cannabinoid system in the brain regulates things like sleep and energy and eating. And so when you're taking this highly potent form of the drug, you're affecting all kinds of brain systems that rely on the cannabinoid receptors to regulate it.
We've been talking about teens, adolescents, and adults, but we haven't said anything specifically about the aging elderly population. Do you have any concerns about substance abuse in the older among us?
So historically, drug use did seem to decline as people got older, that there was a sort of aging out effect, although there are many alcoholics that are over the age of 60 because they never got the message that in general there is an age-related decline in most drug use. What is striking and of some concern is that particularly with the medical marijuana movement and now the legalization of marijuana, is that baby boomers who are retiring and find themselves with extra time and probably extra money are going back to smoking pot on a regular basis. And so, you know, one of the concerns today is, does regular, you know, marijuana use at an older age increase your risk for things like stroke or dementia? Because it's never been studied. It's, you know, it's been hard to study marijuana because it was illegal and it was a class one drug, so it made considered research difficult. But I think that there is concern that we're going to have a wave of people who smoked pot during college who are now going back because it's legal and there aren't the same kinds of social sanctions over it. So, you know, and we're definitely seeing an increase in use in that age group.
The idea that grandma or grandpa might be using some substance, not something I would think that their adult children would necessarily think about and attribute changes in behavior to.
Well, the middle, what I would call the middle generation, you know, the sort of middle-aged 40-year-olds whose parents are now getting older, are often caught in a bind of trying to understand and recognize what's going on with their parents, because they're often living someplace else. They may have only occasional contact with them. And so it's very hard for them to understand when the behaviors are changing or what to do about it. And so it frequently comes to their attention through a crisis. And so, you know, what you see is that the person who's been drinking all of a sudden has falling episodes, and it's the falling episodes that bring them to the hospital. And then, you know, the son or daughter comes in and they're in shock at how bad their parents' drinking has become. I think we're going to see similar kinds of surprises with marijuana. The person who's always been a safe driver their whole life, who has a car wreck, and then, you know, when it's investigated, it turns out that they were getting high and they were driving under the influence. So I think we're going to see some real surprises for people who are used to thinking about their parents as responsible and accountable and are not prepared for this.
In terms of medical marijuana, is it your sense that that is truly an helpful option for many people, or no?
So my concern about medical marijuana is that I think that many of the claims are simply not supported today in medical science. In other words, that if you look at the quality of the studies, very few of these claims would have been strong enough. The evidence, the scientific evidence, is simply not strong enough that it would have been approved as a drug for those indications. You know, when a drug gets approved in the United States, you have to do a whole series of experiments, first to show that they're safe, then you have to do experiments that establish what the correct dosage is, and then you have to do large-scale experiments that show that it really works better than placebo, in other words, a fake drug. You know, when you look at the medical marijuana claims, it's rare that there's any dosing information, that is, because the quality of the marijuana differs from plant to plant and store to store. The studies are usually very small. They rarely have controls. They're of small quality, so that many of these claims, you know, that marijuana helps with fibromyalgia or it helps with insomnia or it helps with anxiety, are really unsupported by good clinical evidence. Now, you know, in fairness, if you make a drug illegal and hard to obtain, it is hard to study. And so one of the things that legitimate investigators in the field have felt for a long time is that by classifying marijuana as a class one drug, meaning that there's no use for which it was legal, it made it very hard to systematically study it. Even so, we have forms of marijuana, drocannabinol and Marinol, that are approved by the FDA for use for nausea related to chemotherapy or wasting disease. So it's not that it couldn't be done, but that the truth is most of the medical claims are exaggerated and were really, from my point of view, an excuse to get marijuana legal. In other words, that this was a way of getting this drug into the public that made it more legal than it had been, because now all you needed was a certificate from a doctor saying that they recommended it.
Dr. Sack, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we will continue. Don't go away, folks. Dr. Sack, so many times when folks are thinking about treatment options for substance abuse, if they've gotten to the point where treatment options are even an option in their minds, the typical thought is that 12-step programs are a part of that. And certainly what I often hear from people is that the 12-step programs don't fit for them and they wish that there was something else. One of the things that is offered at Elements is the Smart Recovery Program. Can you describe the Smart Recovery Program for the listener?
Sure. So in Smart Recovery, the individual is encouraged to focus on behaviors and patterns that that basically take them away from a healthy lifestyle. So the focus isn't necessarily an all-or-nothing view of drugs that says you have to stop all drugs all the time in order to make improvements in your life, but that really looks at life as a progression, that, you know, every day you're trying to make, you know, a difference and make things better. And so Smart Recovery is really built on principles of cognitive behavioral therapy, which says that, you know, if you can understand some of the thoughts that underlie your behavior, that you can change the thoughts and change the behaviors. So we know that cognitive behavioral therapy can be effective for cocaine, for alcohol, for opiates. And so this is really building on that in the context of a support group where people will look at their patterns of thinking and how that influences the decisions they make and therefore move them toward behaviors that are healthier and make it less likely that they're going to use. You know, in 12-step recovery, the view is that first and foremost, you have to stop using first. And so it's the focus is on total abstinence from all drugs all the time. And so it's a very different view of the world. The other thing is that there's a sense in AA that the individual is going to need a lot of help in order to make the changes necessary to overcome their addiction. And so that there is a sense that without the group, that is the AA group or the NA group, meaningful change is not possible. Whereas, you know, Smart Recovery takes a more kind of mental health approach, which says support is good, but that people find motivation both inside and outside and in different ways. And so there's less focus on the importance of the group as opposed to the individual.
With Christian recovery programs, are they different from AA, or is it the 12-step programs, or is it just the 12-step program given another name?
So probably the most widely available support program that's a Christian program is Celebrate Recovery. And Celebrate Recovery applies a lot of the principles of AA, but looks at it through the lens of Christianity. In other words, how does this relate to teachings in the Bible? What can we learn that reinforces this? I think that there is a lot of focus on, you know, the fact that there is a kind of ecumenical quality to AA that may be uncomfortable for people who have strong, you know, religious beliefs. And so, you know, so what it does is it really integrates it with Christian spirituality and culture to make it more relevant to people who have strong religious beliefs.
I noticed as I was preparing for our conversation today that the Elements program has a Cassava recovery app.
Yes, we do. And you can download Cassava for free at both Android Play and the Apple App Store. And really, this is our first effort to get an app that would help people organize their recovery, that would help them kind of keep track of their meetings, to help them find meetings. There's a very powerful meeting finder that's built into Cassava. We also have affirmations in it to kind of help people start their day and give them something to sort of focus on and meditate over. And then, you know, we have a kind of a self-assessment that lets you rate your mood and anxiety so you can see how you're doing, and it'll plot it over time. So there are a lot of helpful tools in Cassava that help people to build their recovery. So it's not meant as a substitution for going to meetings or to having a therapist if that's appropriate, but it's really intended to be a sort of pocket reminder that this is a process that's part of your life and to make it easier for people to follow their recovery plan.
Now, the app also includes a sobriety calculator. What is that?
So the calculator tells you how many days of sobriety you have because you put in your day that you started in recovery. And so, again, you know, time is a very important thing in the AA and NA traditions in terms of the ideas is that, you know, the more time you have, the better you're going to do. And there's a lot of reason to believe that if you have more sober time, you know, you've had more time to acquire new behaviors, new friends, and you've also had more time for the brain to heal. We know that people are at the greatest risk to relapse in their first year after treatment, but that after the first year, relapse rates go way down. And we think that there's an inherent healing process that's going on in the brain that mirrors a lot of the behavioral changes and psychological changes that the individual's experiencing.
Again, as I was preparing for our conversation today, you are essentially all over the place. New York Times, Washington Post, Good Morning America, Huffington Post. It almost seems like if it exists and it has to do with mental health and addiction, you've kind of been there or you're on your way. One of the things that you clearly express concern about is the linking of mental health treatment to violence. You know, every time, I mean, we hear that somebody has done something horrific and violent, then within the first 24-hour news cycle, there's a push for there to be more mental health treatment. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, so I think that the part that concerns me is that most people who are chronically mentally ill are not violent, and that their greatest risks are to themselves. That is, there's a very high lifetime risk of suicide and schizophrenics and bipolars and people with major depression. So that when you talk about the real violence in serious mental disorders, the vast majority of it is directed at the individual themselves. They can't cope with what their life is and they can't live with it. What happens when someone with a mental illness becomes violent towards other people is that it creates an exceptional and irrational fear of people with mental illnesses. You know, most murders in the United States are not committed by people with mental disorders. And although some of the more horrific mass shootings may have involved, you know, mental illness, it's really not indicative of the total problem of gun violence in the United States. So part of my concern is that when we link violence to mental illness, we first of all create a scare, that is that people become even more afraid of people with chronic mental disorders and even less likely to want to help them. And secondarily, you know, we think they create this idea that they should be all locked up, when in fact all of the evidence is that when people are treated in the community with support and services, they do far better than when they're institutionalized. So part of my concern is that we have a homeless problem and a chronic mental health problem, but a lot of it is because we don't fund enough treatment and we make it too hard for people to get services. And so again, you know, when we paint with a broad brush, and if people become afraid of people with mental disorders, that rather than see this as a health problem, in other words, it needs more treatment, they're going to be more inclined to see it as a criminal problem that needs more locking up. And so I think, you know, really, you know, what I'm hoping is that people, you know, understand that these are our friends and family members that have gotten sick and who are in desperately tough circumstances, and we need to find better ways to help them.
When we hear about a particularly horrific event in the news, you know, a lot of folks will say, well, you know, I heard Dr. Sachs say that that's not something that mentally ill typically do, is to reach out and hurt others. They hurt themselves. But you got to be a little bit something to pick up a gun and shoot a bunch of children or blow up a building. So, of course, there's mental illness. What is Dr. Sachs talking about?
So So I think both are true. These are exceptional events and are not characteristic of the vast majority of people with mental disorders, but because of their catastrophic nature, they frighten people. And so the question really is, are there better ways to protect ourselves? You know, and I think that there are laws in many states, including where I live in California, that make it illegal for someone who has been involuntarily detained for psychiatric treatment from possessing a firearm. The problem is that it's very hard to enforce that, you know, and I think that we need to think about how do we ensure that people with chronic mental disorders stay in treatment? How do we find ways to engage them and keep them in treatment that makes the world a safer place for them and for us?
There is so much more work to be done in this area, is it not?
Well, there is, you know, and different approaches have been taken in different places. One of the big initiatives across the United States, but also in France and in other parts of Europe, is something called Housing First that says, you know, you can't wait for the person to get better to offer them housing. That what you do is you offer them housing, and then that tends to make them more willing to accept treatment and to engage in a relationship with the caregivers. And so where Housing First has been applied to people with chronic mental disorders, the results have been significantly better. And so I think that this is really the kind of creative movement that can really affect the lives of people with chronic mental illness, and it's really exciting. I think in other places like New York State and a couple of other states, they've reinstituted a civil commitment procedure that says that you can commit people who are not in an institution and compel them to treatment so that you have at least the tools for going out and imposing treatments on people who may not be, whose judgment may be so impaired that they can't accept them on their own. And I think, again, you know, we don't know yet if that's going to work out and if we're going to get a better outcome. But I think these are some of the attempts that people are making to try to move the needle.
With the Housing First movement, is that the same as halfway houses or sober houses, or is that something different?
So what makes it different is that historically, if somebody wanted to go into a halfway house, they had to agree to stop using drugs or alcohol to be eligible for placement or housing. And many of the chronic mentally ill also drink or smoke marijuana or use cocaine, and so they become ineligible for those kinds of services. And so, you know, the idea here is that's self-defeating, that we can do better by giving them the housing and creating the relationship. And so it really says, we're not going to worry about if they're ready to accept treatment or if they've been compliant as a qualifier for getting into housing and getting them off the street. What we want to do is get them off the street first and then build a relationship. And so that's really what makes it so different. You know, in most situations, you know, indigent housing, one of the conditions is you can't be using drugs or alcohol. Well, most homeless people, you know, over half are using drugs or alcohol, so it disqualifies them immediately.
I see. That's a fascinating program, Housing First. Is it your sense that it will really take on and take over in terms of how we think about treatment options after the initial intensive treatment?
So I think it's going to make a big difference in terms of getting people off the street, but there are challenges. The biggest challenge is that finding places to house them is difficult. In other words, real estate in urban centers is expensive, and finding ways to get apartments that can be suitably supervised and that are appropriate for this purpose is very challenging. And so, you know, we're seeing different strategies being used. You know, some systems have moved away from the large apartment buildings to smaller units. And I think that you know, over time, we're going to learn a lot about it. But, you know, many of the halfway houses or what are called board and cares in California, they don't offer much privacy. People are sharing rooms. They can't close their own door. They don't have their own kitchen. You know, there are things that we can do to make housing more attractive if we have the resources.
What do you find is the acceptance among neighbors of these facilities, the Housing First in particular?
So, you know, again, there's a lot of fear, you know, that it'll hurt housing values. But we see the same thing with drug and alcohol homes. In other words, that sober living houses are often unwelcome in the neighborhoods they're in, even though they tend to be the quietest and most organized because they have supervision, there's a house manager, there are house rules, there are no parties. So the fear of having one of these houses as a neighbor far exceeds the reality of it. But even so, you know, people are worried. You know, for most people, their house is their biggest asset, and they're worried that if there is a halfway house or a sober living nearby, that it's going to hurt their real estate values. Attempts to study this have not supported it. In other words, people have looked at neighborhoods that have a lot of, you know, sober houses or halfway houses versus those that don't. There's no evidence that property values are negatively impacted. But, you know, that's not the whole story. People are worried about the quality of the neighborhood and how does it feel. And I think those are tougher issues to address.
Absolutely. When someone makes the decision to go for inpatient versus outpatient or intensive outpatient treatment when looking at help with addictions, are there particular services or accreditations? How can someone determine that this particular facility versus this facility is the right place for them?
I think it's a great question. So at Elements, all of our treatment programs are Joint Commission accredited. So this is the same organization that accredits hospitals across the United States. And it's really the gold standard of accreditation. So if somebody goes to Promises or the Right Step in Texas or the Ranch in Tennessee, they're going to be going to a program that's been surveyed and has complied not just with state licensing, but with the accreditation authority of the Joint Commission. There's another accrediting organization in the addiction treatment space called CARF, Committee for the Accreditation of Rehabilitation Facilities, that also accredits facilities, and it's a reputable organization. I think any accredited facility, I think, you know, would to me represent a significant step up from unaccredited programs.
Gotcha.
Because there's simply a lot that can go wrong if you don't have standards for training your staff and monitoring them and ensuring that they have the right licensure. There's just a lot that you worry about in terms of safety and treatment efficacy. You know, in terms of what kinds of treatment people need, you know, I think that there's good data that says overall, outpatient treatment doesn't work as well as inpatient treatment or residential treatment for most forms of drug abuse. But part of the reason is that the people who historically have been referred to residential or inpatient treatment have worse addictions. That is, they tend to have more drugs that they've been using. They tend to be using drugs that are harder to stop or they require medically supervised detoxification. And so, you know, I think that the key is to match the setting to the person's behavior. Someone whose drug use is not as severe and who might not meet the full criteria, for instance, for drug dependency, even though their drugs are causing them problems in their lives, might do very well in outpatient, because if you're an outpatient, you can continue to work or care for your kids, get them off to school. So I think a lot of it depends on how severe the drug use or addiction is as to whether they should be in outpatient or in inpatient treatment.
Makes a lot of sense. Doctor, I have to thank you so much for joining us today. Is there a website where folks can go to get more information about you, the work you're doing, all the things we've talked about today?
Absolutely. I think probably the best place to go is the program website for the company, elementsbehavioralhealth.com. So it's elementsbehavioralhealth.com, and you can reach us there. We have descriptions of all of our programs as well as the 800 number to reach us.
Wonderful. Thank you very much for joining us today and giving us such wonderful information about such an important issue.
Well, thanks so much for inviting me. It's a pleasure to be here.
And folks, thank you for joining us today on this edition of Mind Talk. Mind Talk is brought to you daily as an educational public service. It is not intended to replace any work that you might choose to do with a licensed medical, mental health, or other professional. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications. And remember, Mind Talk is available to you on demand by going to myndtalk.org, or you can download the Mind Talk app from the iTunes store. If you'd like to be in touch with me directly, PAMELA, Pamela, at mindtalk.org is the place to go. And folks, if it's unacceptable, it's unacceptable. You take care.